Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
I have asked Robert Riley to come back on the show. He was on recently to discuss his new book, America on Trial, A Defense of the Founding from Ignatius, because we just can't do justice to that book in one sitting, not even perhaps even in two. So I've asked him to come back to discuss the very important chapter in the book on Martin Luther. But before I do that, let me remind you that Bob Riley is the director of Westminster Institute. He was director of Voice of America. He's been senior advisor for information strategy for the U.S. Secretary of Defense, went to Georgetown and Claremont. And he's written a whole string of books that we've discussed on this program, including Making Gay Okay, How Rationalizing Homosexual Behavior is Changing Everything, which is a book that deserves to be remembered given what's going on in the church right now. Bob, welcome back to Church and Culture.
Thank you, Gil. Delighted to be back with you.
You and I have discussed this Luther chapter before when you were actually in the final throes of doing the book, and you were struggling with whether or not, you know, how important this was part of the book. You decided it was an absolutely essential part. And I agree with you. This is my second or third reading of the chapter, but this time I really, you know, dug at it and made all my highlighting and went through there. This is a devastating critique of the legacy of Martin Luther. Now, you're very careful to point out that this legacy was not his intention. He didn't want to come about what came about because of the ideas that he pushed, the ideas that he promulgated through European culture, but that his legacy has been one that has led to a kind of religion of the state, you know, to put it kind of bluntly. And I have always been aware of Luther's differences with Catholics on theology, especially on the effects of original sin, which you discuss. But I have never seen, although you quote many important sources to support your thesis, I've never seen the quote, one quote, which kind of capsulizes the chapter, without Martin Luther would have been no Louis XIV. Shall we start there?
Yeah, and that's said by an Anglican priest. In fact, as you know, most of the quotations in the chapter are from Luther himself, and a number of other quotes are from Lutheran scholars who don't flinch from what they see as the consequences of his ideas, that he did indeed transfer the authority of the church over to the state and made the prince the first bishop of the church, just as the Lutheran churches became, as you know, all national churches. The prince took upon himself the role of local pope. It was to the prince that Luther looked for the reform of the church and for the direction of the clergy, and it was the prince who exercised executive and legislative and judicial authority over the affairs of the church within his kingdom.
So the divine right of kings, which is claimed by Louis XIV and, you know, all other kings of that age and even later, was Luther the reason that the divine right of kings became such a fixed idea in European culture?
Well, I think the divine right of kings is a Protestant doctrine it was always considered heretical by the Catholic Church, even though it was espoused by certain Catholic thinkers like Jean Baudin. And Louis XIV certainly enjoyed close to absolute power. The problem was that when the churches were nationalized, as they all were, after the Reformation and the religious wars that ensued because of it, those areas that remained Catholic did so because they had Catholic princes or Catholic kings. So the church became more dependent than it had been, certainly since the early 11th century, on the monarch or the prince. It is out of this that the famous marriage of scepter and altar grew, and why the churches became so closely associated with the royal rule. That had not been the case in the Middle Ages, but it was a result of the Reformation and the nationalization of churches. On to the larger question you asked, Neil, Luther removed, as you know, natural law as the basis or as the foundation for the development of constitutional government, as it had been that basis in the Middle Ages, which had recognized the principle of equality, the sovereignty of the people, the requirement of consent. They had to consent in their rule, and the right to revolution if the sovereign broke the compact with the people that empowered him in the first place. So he exercised power conditionally insofar as he fulfilled his duties. Now, that all of those ideas were alien to Luther, and as they all have their foundation in natural law, along with certain Catholic Christian understandings, Luther explicitly rejected them. He did not believe in the sovereignty of the people. He thought the people were the problem. Authority was directly invested by God in the ruler. The ruler was only accountable to God. The ruler was not subject to his own laws. Only the people were. Even someone taken to be a tyrant who imposed upon the people terrible laws and actions did not empower the people to engage in revolt against him. There was no right to rebellion in Luther.
I don't want to bypass the argument you make about his Luther, that is, relationship to Ockham, William of Ockham, who began the destruction of the Thomistic synthesis of faith and reason, that reason could no longer reason partially, part of the way toward God, toward using the logos-infused natural world and the special power of the human intellect to know truths up to a certain point. So what you finally get with Luther, who, as you show in your chapter, just read all of Ockham, kept reading Ockham his whole life, and that, in other words, that was his philosophical foundation, not Thomas Aquinas, who he despised, to, you have one quote from Luther: reason cannot think correctly about God, only faith can do so. And
right.
I want you to explain to our listeners how this fundamental break of reason and faith led to this outcome you just described.
Well, as you rightly point out its sources in William of Ockham, who was a Catholic priest in the late Middle Ages, who overthrew the general theological understanding that in God's essence, the divine intellect led the will. In other words, in God, reason rules, the will then executes what reason directs. Why is this? Because God is logos. God is, in his essence, reason. Now, this was flipped by William of Ockham, who said, no, it's the primacy of will in God. The will directs reason. The reason is just instrumental in finding the best ways to fulfill what the will desires. And God's will and power is unlimited. God is unaccountable. God is not directed by anything but his own will. And he can will anything except something in opposition to the principle of non-contradiction. But he can do things. Ockham said notoriously that God can require us to hate him. And we couldn't gainsay that. We have to do whatever God tells us to. Why did he say that? He said this because for God to exercise the absolute power that Ockham said he possessed, there could be no such thing as natural law. There could be no order in nature because there was no nature. Things had no essences. God constituted each thing individually at every instant of its existence. There was no such thing as human nature. There was no nature. Therefore, we couldn't really tell what things were. They didn't have essences. Now, Ockham wanted to move in this direction because he thought it was required for God's absolute freedom. But it sort of left man enchained. He had no way, therefore, through his reason, to come to know what is right and what is wrong. Why? Because since things had no nature, nothing was inherently right or wrong or inherently just or unjust. There was no standard by which one could say something's right or wrong. Well, how would one know? Only through divine revelation. It's God who tells you what's right and wrong. Well, why does he do that? Nobody knows. Since God is pure will and power, he's incomprehensible, and there are no reason. He acts for no reasons. That is why God, at one instant, could command that he be loved, and you would have to do that. But then he could turn around in the next instant and say, well, no, now it's obligatory that you hate me, because there's nothing right or wrong in those things themselves, but only that God says so. That's it.
You know, and I wrote you earlier today because I read a quote from Luther, and I'm going to read it, which is a very good example of how Luther uses this Occam's voluntarism, which is another way of talking about the will precedes the intellect. And Luther writes, God is he for whose will no cause or ground may be laid down as its rule and standard, for nothing is on a level with it or above it, but it is itself the rule for our things, that is the will. If any rule or standard or cause or ground existed for it, it would no longer be the will of God. That is, God would not be free and absolute. What God wills is not right because he ought. In other words, he's not obeying some duty or was bound to do so to will. On the contrary, what takes place must be right because he so wills it. So, as you say, God's will can, as Ockham says, be to hate him. Causes and grounds are laid down for the will of the creature, but not for the will of the Creator unless you set another Creator over him. And as I wrote you, you know, it seems like, you know, that Luther is limiting God in this statement. He's limiting God in the sense that he's saying that God would be unable to make a world in which the Logos ordered existence and created man with reason able in a limited way to grasp its presence. In other words, Luther completely leaves that possibility out. So he's the one limiting God.
Yeah, he clearly denies it, as did Occam. You know, this description of God and his will that you just read from Luther reminds me very strongly of the statement of Thrasymachus in Plato's Republic, when Thrasymachus says to Socrates that right is the rule of the stronger.
Right.
So it's the stronger who gets to say what's right, and it's only right because the stronger says it. And in this case, at a theological level, God's the strongest. And that's the only reason why he gets to say what's right or what's wrong. There's nothing inherently right or wrong. And you're completely correct to say what Luther does is rob from God the moral the moral order and divine reason that is inherent in him, that is indeed his essence.
It's like he's saying we're not going to allow the fact that God might have the option of making the world such that human reason could come to understand some of the basic truths about existence. In other words, we're not even going to give God the option of doing that.
I think so. And then, of course, you have added to that problem that none of this matters in a way because of Luther's view of the effects of original sin.
Right.
And that man is so degraded by it that his reason is, you know, were there a natural law for him to follow in a moral way, his reason is too blinded by the effects of that sin. He couldn't possibly know it, and his will is totally enslaved to his passions, to concupiscence. Man is totally degraded.
So even faith itself is something willed in individuals by God. It's not something that any individual has anything to do with.
Right. There is no... faith is not something to which a man assents in receiving the grace of faith. It is simply preordained by God, and I have in that chapter some very rough statements by Luther saying that God sends to hell whom he wills and to heaven whom he wills.
Well, let me read one of them. Let me read one, because I had it.
You want to read it? Sure.
I had it highlighted. Now, if you are disturbed by the thought that it is difficult to defend the mercy and justice of God when he damns the undeserving, that is to say, ungodly men who are what they are because they were born in ungodliness and can in no way help being and remaining ungodly and damnable, but are compelled by the necessity of nature to sin and to perish, rather must God be honored and revered as supremely merciful toward those whom he justifies and saves, supremely unworthy as they are, and this is the kicker, and there must at least be some acknowledgement of his divine wisdom so that he may be believed to be righteous where he seems to us to be unjust.
There you go. You see, that's by definition, whatever God does is righteous because he's the strongest. He gets to decide what is righteous. And for whatever puny human being may think is righteous, that's absolutely irrelevant to God, as there's no relationship between your mind and the divine intellect. You see, that's what both Occam and Luther severed, that relationship. And that's why, as you said earlier, why can't God have created a world through his divine logos, as we know from the beginning of the Gospel of St. John is exactly what he did. And that's why it has a rational order, and he endows men with reason, and man, reflecting upon this order in nature, can reason to its creator. And all of that's gone. That's gone in Luther. There's no natural theology left. It's gone in Occam.
Now, I want our listeners to understand step by step, how did this lead to vesting state, the prince, with religious power over his subjects? How did that lead to this?
Well, it led to it because...
Luther completely stripped away, he burned medieval canon law in front of the church in Wittenberg in 1520. So the whole structure of Christendom and its relationship to the state that existed during the Middle Ages, and Christendom, you know, the church was a buffer between unjust rule of princes and dukes and so forth. In other words, the church could check the power of the prince. But that is lost now once he has done away with church authority and particularly canon law.
The freedoms of the Middle Ages and the development of all the modern constitutional principles that grew in the Middle Ages was a direct result of the dual sovereignty of the secular realm and the ecclesiastical realm. When Luther destroyed the realm of the institutional church, when it destroyed the corporations of the church, all the power that had been invested in those institutions and corporations was, if for no other reason, by default,
yes,
transferred to the state, to the prince.
Which he celebrated.
Plus, the teaching that we mentioned a bit earlier, that since there is no popular sovereignty, since God, according to him, invests the prince directly with his authority, there's no contesting it. Right? There are no other grounds of authority other than God giving that authority directly, which is why no matter how unjust the prince is, who after all is acting in a preordained way, the people have no right to revolution against him because they would then be contesting the will of God, which is
because the prince's will is a reflection of God's will, which is not subject to any rule of reason or subject to any natural law.
Correct. And Luther says that in one of the quotes I have in that chapter, which is really, again, couldn't be clearer. I'm not sure I can. Oh, here it is. The princes of this world are gods. The common people are Satan, through whom God sometimes does what at other times he does directly through Satan. That is, make rebellion as a punishment for people's sins. Now, it is better to suffer wrong from one tyrant, that is, from the ruler, than from unnumbered tyrants, that is, the mob. Now, it couldn't really be much clearer that this is the basis for state absolutism that was further developed in the divine right of kings by the Stuarts in England, and of the secular version of the absolute power of the state developed by Thomas Hobbes in his Leviathan.
Yeah, I think you make a very persuasive argument that of the bridge that is created to Hobbes. Now, I want to come back and quote one of your citations from Heinrich Bulmer, who was a German biographer of Luther. He says, the result of these innovations was also a great secularization, principally in favor of temporal power. The latter, that is temporal power, gained full freedom of movement throughout the wide field of secular life. Indeed, it soon succeeded in obtaining the direction of all purely spiritual matter, too. Government, as the holder of the paternal power, claimed authority over all departments of social life. This is totalitarianism.
It's the ultimate basis for it. I mean, we're still not quite at the age of ideology that comes a bit later, as you know. But there you go. Yeah, I mean, this was a huge setback for limited government and for any further development in constitutional government.
But you also make the point, Bob, that it wasn't just the Protestant princes who adopted this. Catholic princes adopted it, too.
Well, I mean, they couldn't be happier that they regained many of the powers that they had lost during what's called the Papal Revolution, beginning in the late 11th century, when they had claimed themselves to be the local heads of the church and able to nominate and invest bishops. And as you know, that led to a huge struggle as the two swords teaching, the dual sovereignty teaching, was established through that struggle during the Middle Ages until it became generally acknowledged that these two realms, the ecclesiastical and the secular, had distinct responsibilities, and they could not transgress each other. Now, that's all gone with Luther.
We're going to continue talking about Bob Riley's chapter on Luther from his book, America on Trial, A Defense of the Founding, which I consider something of a masterpiece. Bob, don't blush. We'll be back with Bob Riley and America on Trial after a brief message.
How do you keep peace in the family? Author, speaker, TV host Donna Marie Cooper O'Boyle says invite the Queen of Peace and the Prince of Peace into your home. And she tells us how to do that. Hi, this is Peggy Stanton. Join the conversation on A Place of Peace. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net.
Hi there, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak.
Research shows that when families openly live and share their faith together, they're more able to respond positively to the challenges they face every day.
So if you're looking for help in creating that joyful place where each member of your family experiences life as a gift from God, then you will want to check out our book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide for Raising Faithful Kids.
You can find this book on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, we revisit a fundamental question that is often asked and often not well understood. What exactly is meant by the different rites of the Catholic Church? How and why are they different?
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
This week on Christ is the Answer, Father John Ricardo finishes his talk on the responsibilities men have as men, husbands, and fathers. After that, he asks a simple question to the Bravehearts Men's Group in Orion, Michigan. What makes kings from slaves? And to end the week, we begin our journey into the teachings of the Catholic Church with Father John's series on RCIA for Catholics. Tune in for Christ is the Answer, Monday through Fridays at 11 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
Thank you.
am back with Bob Riley. We're talking about Martin Luther. And let me stress once again, as I said at the top of the show, and as Bob Riley stresses throughout his chapter, that these outcomes, these effects of his legacy were not intended by him. He did not see these things coming that would result from his teaching. And so we're not trying to indict Luther directly. We're just pointing out that these basic moves of the denial of natural law, the divorce of faith and reason, the attributing will as the primary characteristic of God, subordinating reason, and then destroying the, as Bob put it, the corporate structure of the church, which was the one a part of the dual swords, keeping each other from excess. With the sacred sword gone, it gave these political rulers absolute power. And, Bob, I keep thinking it's no wonder that Germany was the place where Hitler emerged.
Well, I think we've got to be careful there. But there are certain things that were a result of the political result of Luther's teaching and this transfer of power to the state. It led to a reverence, let us say, for the sovereign that was absent from places where this was not the case. The ruler became sacred, as I say in that chapter, as a result, that Luther re-sacralized the ruler. Which it had been the work of the Middle Ages to desacralize the ruler. All of these notions were completely alien to the Middle Ages. So that reverence for the prince, for the ruler, for the secular authority was so tremendously enhanced as a result of the Reformation that contesting public authority was unthinkable. It just
right.
was not, it became sort of inconceivable. It doesn't mean it didn't happen. And if we look at the latter stages of the Weimar Republic and what then took place during Hitler's reign, you've got such extraordinary examples of Lutheran resistance as Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Right.
One of the great, great heroes, but he was the exception. I've been reading a good bit about this period in history and wondering from where the resistance did come and why. And most of the resistance came from southern Germany and Bavaria, from
the Catholic part of it.
Catholics, and
yeah.
notably from Jesuits. And in fact, one Jesuit who was a central part of the plotting against Hitler took Dietrich Bonhoeffer to a Benedictine abbey in the mountains in southern Germany, where it's thought that Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was still, hesitant about engaging in a plot against the ruler, even an unjust ruler, we've already gone over that issue, was taught Catholic just war teaching. And the Catholic understanding of the right to revolution against tyranny, which had been standard in the Middle Ages, standard Catholic understanding. And in fact, if you look at the voting patterns late in the Weimar Republic, the strongest support for the Nazi Party came in the north, in the predominantly Lutheran areas,
right.
and weakest in the south in the predominantly Catholic areas. Again, I don't mean to suggest that there is some kind of direct connection between the two. My only point is that the reverence for strong authority, the hesitancy to contest that authority, because it in some way is invested with God's authority, meant that a man who exhibited that kind of strength and power as Hitler did not meet much resistance. Now, I have read a good deal about all the plots against Hitler, of which there were many more than is generally known. And Catholics were involved, but also were Protestants, also were Lutherans. Now, most of the generals who were encouraged to get involved, and some of whom wanted to, were not Catholic, and they would only hope that they would not agree to killing Hitler. They would only agree that maybe he could be, you know, kidnapped and bargained with or something, but you don't kill the sovereign of the state. And when others had committed to the plot, not especially this abduction idea, but to removing him and if necessarily killing him, when the push came to shove and the time was to commit and execute a plan, they wouldn't do it. They couldn't bring themselves to that act of defiance.
Until von Stauffenberg.
Until von Stauffenberg, until, you know, so it's very interesting to see the psychology of these men who knew there was something profoundly wrong, but couldn't really see that they had a right, in fact, an obligation to do something about it. And that comes from somewhere, and, you know, I'm...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's... we're all products of our history, right? We're a product of history.
And culture is based on cult. And the Lutheran cult has certain elements in it. You know, what the problem here is not that it directly involves itself in the secular realm. It's that it doesn't. It's that it divorces itself completely from it. That when it's a product of the divorce of reason and faith. Faith becomes the separate realm. You know, you are saved by God, and that's basically all she wrote. It doesn't impinge upon the secular order, since reason is completely corrupt and incapable of knowing good and evil and has absolutely no role in salvation. It's cut off and left on its own, which is why in those areas of Germany and other Lutheran areas, we saw the first development of legal positivism, that is, law based upon the will of the ruler, or law based upon the legislator's will. It's not law based upon reason. It's not law that tries to make itself, to accommodate itself, to cohere with natural law defining what is just and unjust. So the law becomes untethered from any standard of justice. It's just an expression of the will of the ruler, and as such, must be obeyed as such. You see the harm, even if it doesn't lead directly to something as terrible as Hitler, that legal positivism has within it tremendous dangers, and those dangers are manifest today.
They are, and, you know, I sort of led you to the Hitler question because I wanted our listeners to understand, not so much, we're not trying to demonize Hitler for this, but to show how I, as Richard Weaver would put it, ideas have consequences. And these consequences are often not what writers, intellectuals, religious leaders think they will be. What do you think, in Luther's own mind, what do you think he was, what outcome do you think he foresaw for his ideas?
Well, I think it's largely what he achieved, which was the destruction of the institutional church, the untethering of reason from faith. Oh, what it achieved, I should say, because we haven't touched upon this at all, deal, is what it achieved for him personally. As you know, he was a very tortured man, a man suffering from massive scrupulosity who, as an Augustinian monk, would spend 3-4 hours at a crack in the confessional, and his spiritual counselor trying to, you know, Luther, lighten up, everything isn't a sin. For him, everything was a sin. Temptation was the sin, not the thing, the act that you might fall into as a result of the temptation. Being tempted was a sin. And it was because of this all-consuming idea that everything was a sin that he felt himself living under doom, that God's judgment of him was going to be so harsh. This unknown God, this Deus Absconditus, was going to condemn him because all he saw in himself was sin. And Luther himself, by the way, wrote, and I'm quoting him, "In every good work, a righteous man sins."
Yes.
Unquote. So how do you, what's the way out? He found the way out by saying that salvation came sola fide, by faith alone, unrelated to acts. Man can do nothing that contributes to his salvation, even in cooperation with grace. It's all God's doing. God bestows salvation on whom he will. And if man believes, trusts in God, he receives this incomparable gift. But nothing man does is related to that salvation. So it was, you can imagine the psychological relief. And it was for this reason that Luther emptied the monasteries and the convents, that he forbade any intercessory prayer, that he eliminated the Book of Maccabees because there were prayers for the dead in it, that he forbade pilgrimages. Intercessory prayer was to him heretical because things were already foreordained and there was no relationship between your behavior and salvation. So what are you doing in a monastery? Get
right
out. So they were driven out and told to get married, and as you know, he married a nun. So there's that aspect to this radical teaching, that it solved a profound personal problem.
Yeah, he evidently, on a personal level, he became rather, how do I put it, he lost his monk's discipline, as it were. He just gave him way to a kind of bourgeois life, correct?
Well, I don't know about that in particular. Of course, the man was incredibly productive.
Oh, yeah.
And highly creative.
And brilliant. And utterly brilliant. I mean,
his music.
Yeah. His biblical commentaries are brilliant.
And his sort of hymns to Christ's mercy are very beautiful. There are some beautiful things in Luther. There are also some very ugly things. So we can't quite homogenize him completely, but as you know, he had a family and children and lived comfortably. Was dismayed by the number of other Protestant groups that sprang up, that if every man was his own priest and could interpret Scripture as he chose, it was inevitable that Protestantism would fracture. And as you know, today is, I forget how many thousands of Protestant sects there are, but that central source of authority in the church was gone with the destruction of the church.
At the very end of the chapter, you quote one of my favorite authors. I know he's one of yours, Eric Vergelin. And you quote him as saying that the destruction that was the legacy of the Reformation went so deep that Western society has never completely recovered from the blow. What did he mean?
Well, look at the two things he said that were the victims of the in the wake of the Reformation. He said the taboo had to fall on classic philosophy and scholastic theology. And since under those two heads came the major and certainly decisive part of Western intellectual culture, this culture was ruined to the extent to which the taboo became effective. Indeed, it was. I mean, what can you... Classic philosophy and scholastic theology, that's the you know, the king and queen of knowledge.
Well, Western civilization.
In Western civilization. So if those are under taboo, think of what you've lost. You've pulled two of the major struts out from underneath your civilization. And the costs from this have been just tremendously great, tremendously severe. I don't think Baudelin was exaggerating.
You also...
damage.
You also make the point that Luther prepared the way for Machiavelli, the prince. Explain that to our listeners.
Yeah, well, it's just that since you've severed religious from public life, and you've left the sovereign will as authoritative, not only in the secular sphere, but also in the sphere of the church, that ruler can then subordinate religion to his political desires. And that's exactly what Machiavelli advised the ruler to do, to utilize religion as a tool of power in his reign. Now, you can't say that Luther wanted the prince to do that. You know, he had this notion of an ideal Christian prince who would be, the summus episcopus of the Lutheran church in his realm. But Machiavelli, Machiavelli didn't believe in Christian princes. He believed in amoral princes. And indeed, we see around that same time of the Renaissance, because Machiavelli and Luther lived at least for 40 years, and they were contemporaries.
Right.
The emergence of the Machiavellian prince, who sought through an unscrupulous manner to utilize all these elements of power to perpetuate his power in his reign.
And by the way, power is another word for voluntarism.
Yes, might makes right.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, Machiavelli said, where there are good arms, there are good laws.
Is the principle you're describing here part of what we meet when we meet people or groups that really have made politics their religion? They really believe that is the most ultimate thing in their lives, politics.
I can't see that exactly, because Luther certainly did not see politics as a path to salvation. He thought exactly the opposite. But what he didn't envisage is not only would there someday not be Christian princes, but that the Christian faith on which he relied so much would recede and certainly would be largely gone from public life. So what are you left with then, with the people who are without faith now? They're really without grace, they're without faith, and they don't believe in scriptures. They still need some means of salvation.
Yes.
And it's most likely they will then adopt a modern ideology that proposes politics as salvific. Politics becomes that means of transforming reality in that way that Christians believe that Christ, through his sacrifice, transformed reality through his saving grace and inviting us into the inner life of the Godhead. They'd say, well, no, we don't need Christ for this. We can do this right here. All we need is political control.
You know, going back to your point about Luther's view of human nature as being completely fallen, even when it comes to the principles, first principles of reason, which Aquinas said were not destroyed by the fall. That's a whole other interesting avenue to go down to see, to look at the differences there. But the fact that God, it's God's will alone that is responsible for one man having faith and another not, what's the point of even trying to be religious or trying to be spiritual if none of what you do matters?
There isn't. I mean, that's the famous debate between Erasmus and Luther. And Luther's side was expressed in his book, The Bondage of the Will, that the will was in bondage, the will had no freedom, that the will could not do anything to affect man's salvation, that it was all a matter predetermined by God's will, and there was really nothing you could do about it.
And I think, didn't Erasmus sort of joke about it? Like, why should I even seek forgiveness of my sins? Or?
Well, he made a bigger joke about the Reformation. He said it ended as a comedy. And by that, he was making an allusion to classical comedy, which always ends in everybody getting married.
Right.
And sort of since Luther got married, he's hitting the nail on the head there.
The we have only a few minutes left, Bob, but has this chapter been a subject of some controversy in the reception of your book?
Well, it's been commented on by some, you know, especially by Protestant reviewers who say I got it wrong, or at least they defend Calvinism, which is perhaps the only relevant subject to the American founding because of the predominance of Calvinism in the northeastern colonies.
Yes.
The rest were mainly Anglican.
Right.
But the point I make, at least in a very substantial footnote in the book, is that Calvinism in the late 18th century was a very, very different thing from what it was in the 16th century.
In Geneva, yes.
And as you know, I don't address Calvin in this book. My point isn't to attack the Reformation or really to attack Luther. The pivot of the whole book is the struggle between the primacy of reason and the primacy of will. And I deal with Luther only insofar as within his teachings we see the primacy of the will exercised over the primacy of reason. And as we've been discussing, I look at what were the political consequences of that theology.
And well, you know what I'd like
to... He was a political philosopher. He was a theologian. But that didn't keep the consequences flowing from it.
You know, what is it, the law of unintended consequences? We've been discussing Bob Riley's book, which I think is very important, frankly, for people to understand, as it were, how the modern world became what it was and how we have the rise of skepticism, the denial of the ability to know truth, the moral law, and so forth. It's called America on Trial, A Defense of the Founding. But in defending the founding, Bob has gone all the way back to the middle, to medieval understanding of natural law and brought it forward. And in future weeks on Church and Culture, I plan on returning to the book and picking up some of the other important chapters. Bob, are you willing to do that?
Oh, deal. I would be delighted, as you know.
Well, we'll do it. But right now, Bob, I want to thank you for being on Church and Culture again.
Deal. Thank you very much.
And to our listeners, we'll be back on this day and this time next week.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.